Plantas, ¿no? Por eso nosotros queríamos eso, conyema, que nos apoyen eso, nosotros que nos dé, por ejemplo, no tenemos, tengo yo 6 hijos que están estudiando, ¿quién le va a comprar su cuaderno?
Irgilia Rengifo and Julia Perez, their husbands Edwin Chota and Jorge Rios, were killed in September along with 2 other Peruvian environmental activists. That does it for our broadcast today. As we wrap up today's program, we'll be bringing you broadcasts throughout the week on from the UN Climate Summit. It's called COP20, the Conference of Parties, the binding summit next year in Paris, France. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Clara Ibarra, Andres Contreras, Dennis Moynihan, Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, David Prude. And our website is democracynow.org. There you can see all of our coverage of climate change from the People's Climate March in September, our 3-hour broadcast special, everything leading up to today, as well as our past coverage of the climate summits from Copenhagen to Cancun, from Doha to Durban, as well as the People's Summit that took place in Bolivia. We're here all week in Lima, Peru. DemocracyNow.org has the podcast, the video, and the audio, as well as our transcripts. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll get a report on the weekend's protests challenging police violence in Portland and nationwide, and look at next steps for the city of Portland.
KBOO's reporter on the ground in Lima, Peru, brings us the voices of activists calling for climate justice as fossil fuel industry representatives continue to dominate the global climate talks.
As the deadline approaches for the recount on the measure to label genetically modified organisms in Oregon, supporters of labeling file a lawsuit alleging that not all the votes were counted.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 8th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. On Saturday, December 6, a demonstration protesting a lack of indictment for the police in the cases of Michael Brown's shooting death and Eric Garner's choking death took place at the Portland Justice Center downtown. The protesters marched from the Justice Center down NATO Parkway and eventually took over the Pioneer Courthouse Square Mall. We were able to capture some of the speeches of those leading the demonstration.
My name is Mitch Purcell, and today I'm here as a private citizen, but I do work for a civil rights organization that has been doing this work for a very, very, very long time. You know, after the big demonstration when Michael Brown's killers were not indicted, there was a message in the media that was, I think, meant to divide us. It said that generational, we couldn't come together across the generations. It said that young people and old people, black people and white people, and brown people could not come together. But I'm here to say that we are not divided. We are not divided across race. We are not divided across age. We are united in a common purpose. And that common purpose is justice. Yes. That common purpose is justice for Michael Brown. That common purpose is justice for Eric Garner. That common purpose is justice for the people in Portland that have been killed by police violence and have not yet, some almost a decade, have not yet achieved justice. We are here today to say we will not rest until justice is done. One of the things that we were told when Michael Brown and Eric Garner's killers did not face justice was that because their killing was in the parameters of the law. That's what the grand jury said, that their killings were lawful. They were in the parameters of the law. So what does that say to us? That say we have to change the law. That's what it says to me, that we have to change the law. So I hope that as we lift our voices in protest, we don't forget the due diligence that we have to do. We have to be in the places where the laws are made. You know, we have to be in Salem. We have to be in the halls of city halls. If those laws are unjust, we are going to change those laws. So let's be mindful as we march that we also have to plan. We have to plan an agenda. We have to plan an agenda for change, and we have to do that today. So we are here with you. There's going to be, this is just the beginning. There's going to be many, many, many action and many, many movements until we see the change that we want to see. There's going to be another demonstration by some of those traditional organizations on December 20th, and I hope to see all of you there. And I also hope that you will continue to support the efforts of Don't Shoot PDX, because they have been doing a fabulous job. So thank you very much. So everybody, that's a very good way to segue into something that I have to say. One of the things that Colin mentioned is that his personal belongings were seized by the police. And so I wanted to read something that is very interesting. A couple of our reporters, a couple of our bloggers, a couple of our friends have been arrested over the past couple of weeks. And there's sometimes when you have cash on you, what'll happen is that over there at Multnomah County, they'll give you an ATM card, the NUMMI card. And so how many people have heard about that? How many people know about that card? Okay. Well, okay, if you are arrested in Multnomah County, the Multnomah County Sheriff takes your money and gives you back an ATM card with all sorts of fees. In other words, even though you are presumed innocent, you have to pay a private company to get your money back. If you are locked up in county jails, then your family or friends or loved ones can no longer visit you in prison. They have to pay $20 or more for a 20-minute visit to visit another private corporation. No one knows about this. We are only finding out about this because this is happening. The sheriff is stealing people's money. They are locking up people who haven't been convicted of anything, but now you have to pay to see them, and you can't even do it in person. The companies that are doing this is Securus Technology and NUMMI Financial. They're making big bucks off of the poor and the innocent, and so is the Multnomah County Sheriff. They get paid every time someone is forced to use this video service to see their loved ones in jail. These contracts were approved by Multnomah County Sheriff, the county, and the district attorney. Our sheriffs lock up over 20,000 people a year, and they are profiting from it. This is information that you need to know. Your elected officials in Portland, Mayor Charlie Hills, and the city commissioners, Amanda Fritz, Nick Fish, Steve Novick, and Dan Saltzman, they all know about this, but they say it's not their responsibility. It's Multnomah County, so this is their policy, and their policy of locking up citizens in the city where they preside and where they say it's none of their responsibility. So is this their responsibility?
Yes!
Do those citizens that are going to jail in Multnomah County belong in Multnomah County? Yes, they do. And there's 20,000 of them every year that are being locked up, and their money is being taken through this system. So who are they representing?
Whose interests are they serving? In my opinion, they're serving the interests of this financial corporation.
Those were the leaders and organizers of Saturday's protests that originated in front of the Justice Center.
Following the rally and march on Saturday, organizers with a number of organizations gathered at Portland State University on Sunday. At the Sunday event, people tried to plan the next steps for the Don't Shoot PDX Coalition. KBOO's Don Merrill was there and brings us this report.
Sunday night on the PSU campus is what you would expect a Sunday night to be, days before Christmas break. Students lugging backpacks, heading to Miller Library for a long night of studying before finals. But there was something else going on.
The only thing that we can do right now is be responsible for looking forward and staying focused and staying together and keeping each other safe, keeping each other uplifted, taking care of one another.
That's Portland activist Teresa Rayford. She was helping lead an occupation of the third floor of Miller Library Sunday night.
Okay, so that's my thing.
According to Ms. Rayford, some version of this Don't Shoot PDX group has been meeting for several weeks on the PSU campus. But this event, which intended to march on the PSU library, had nearly 2,500 likes on Facebook as of Sunday afternoon.
I'm King Bishop Styles, part of the Three Kings of Portland, and I'm right with Teresa.
Several people spoke to the group of about 100 protesters, and while some of those voices were relatively new, others are long mainstays in Portland's civil rights struggles.
And so, thank you for showing up. Thank you for doing your piece.
This is former Oregon Congresswoman and longtime Portland civil rights activist Joanne Hardesty.
The Portland Right to the City Coalition. And it's a newly formed group that came together about 6 months ago.
Ms. Hardesty told the group that this new group is being formed within city government to help citizens have more of a role in governing the city of Portland that she hopes and expects will do a better job than what it's had up to this point.
So a small group of people have been getting together for the last 6 months saying, we have to take our city back. And this evening, because we knew that this group was meeting tonight, we came up with a list of demands for the city council, and we want to present it to you because this week, Portland City Council will be voting on spending over $600,000 to put body cameras on Portland police officers. And let me tell you, if you don't already know, that it won't make any of us safer. So this Wednesday, the Portland City Council will be voting. I hope you will join the Right to the City Coalition and telling the City Council to vote no. How about investing $600,000 in police oversight?
After a moment of silence and some housekeeping instructions.
And it's kind of like a rectangle space. And so if we could all actively try and, like, we're going to be sitting on the floor. And so just to make sure we leave the elevators open so there's enough access for a wheelchair, we'll be safe.
Right on.
The group is on the march.
I was very indifferent about social justice issues, but I, Sierra Davis, I recognize that the fight for equality that, you know, stories I heard from like my grandma and even my mom, that fight still exists for my generation. And I would hate for my generation to become indifferent or for my children to be apathetic to, you know, their generations, Trayvon or Tamir Rice or Mike Brown. And so that's really why I'm out here.
So about 100 people are on their way into the PSU library. They were walking through and getting a lot of looks from administrative staff and other students.
Can you tell me why you're participating in this march?
Well, I'm a board member with the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee.
Okay, and what's your name?
My name is Crystal Contreras Grossman. So I've been doing work against the private prison industry for probably the last 3 years. My family has personally experienced police violence, and you know, I see the profiling and stuff that's going on in our communities, and you know, I'm here to reach out and build alliances with other groups that are impacted by those same policies.
Okay, we're now on the third floor, and we are moving among the stacks. A very orderly group. For about the next hour, 100 people sitting on the floor in the third floor hallway introduced themselves and shared stories about why they were participating in the event.
My name is Nam. I'm a member of a few groups in town, and I also work pretty much exclusively at, I work in anti-racist action or amongst other things.
People spoke very honestly about their feelings, but one young man, a white student named Ryan, was especially, even painfully honest.
How long until, you know, it's not just, and I'm sorry if this comes across the wrong way, but how long until it's not just people of color that are targeted, and it's people of all colors and all communities? I mean, we're in a police state, and it's only growing stronger, and it's up to us to stop it. Ryan Miller, hello.
The meeting ended with phone numbers and emails being exchanged. Small steps in a big task. I'm Don Merrill, Cable News.
In addition to protests and vigils that are taking place every couple of days in Portland, the Right to the City Coalition has announced that they plan to submit a series of demands at this week's City Council meeting. The demands will be delivered as public testimony regarding Mayor Hale's agenda item seeking authorization of a proposal to divert funds and issue a contract for the purchase of an on-body camera system. That item will cost the city $1 million. One of the key demands is that the city drop its appeal of a federal judge's decision that the city report each year on its progress on implementing the Department of Justice reforms regarding the excessive use of force by Portland police.
A panel of community members will gather tomorrow evening for a public conversation about migrant justice and the policing of migrant communities. The group will facilitate discussions about how to forward migrant justice and ways to view things like detention centers, border control, immigration reform, and migrant labor. The conversation is the third of a five-part monthly series about policing in Portland. The event takes place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. tomorrow at Red and Black Cafe. I spoke with Romeo Sosa, the executive director for VAW's Workers' Rights Education Project. Sosa will be on tomorrow's panel, speaking from an immigrant perspective. If people are planning on going to the panel tomorrow, what can they expect?
They're going to be a list of panelists there, and from different perspectives, and I think mine is from the perspective of immigrants.
Can you tell me a little bit about the general state of things in Portland regarding ICE and the policing of migrants and communities of color?
I think one of the dangerous parts that when our law enforcement is cooperating with ICE, which is the Immigration Customs Enforcement, used to be the Immigration Naturalization Services, that stay cooperating with them through different ways. One of the ways is through the secure communities. Secure communities is a way that the information, when you have your fingerprints in jail, so automatically goes to the FBI to check your background, and also it goes to ICE. So automatically ICE knows that somebody's is arrested, and they check in the database, and they don't have the information of that person, and they immediately put a hold on that person. Even if you commit like a minor crime, just the fact that you don't have any driver license, because in the state of Oregon they don't give that driver license to undocumented people anymore. So that put in dangerous that like the public safety, because a lot of our people, they don't want to interact with the police anymore. They don't want to denounce any if they are witness of anything, of a crime or domestic violence. So they're afraid to denounce it because the connection between the police and immigration.
You mentioned a little bit about driver's licenses. So how does the recent failure of the driver card measure play into all this?
And I think it's another way that we can see the state of Oregon. We need to work more hard to welcome the immigrants in here, because it shows that it was really the opposite to what we're thinking the state we live with. So I think for us, we're going to work hard and see how we can make sure that our population, they're not going to get intimidating or arrested by police and ICE.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with labor activist Francisco Aguirre and what his struggles represent in the kind of grand scheme of things?
Yeah, that's another example of the situation of immigrants here. So the situation of Francisco is that he got a DUI. So anybody can go through to the system that's supposed to be but the problem is they connected with ICE. So after he got released from jail, and automatically that notification somehow the immigration they know where he lives, and I think it's a few days after they went to his home and tried to arrest him. But he knows he's right, and they didn't arrest him because they say that they have like a warrant, and they didn't have a warrant in that moment when they show up at his home. And also, the other thing, it's pretty clear to me. I saw some of the in Clackamas County Jail, and they provide information to ICE, and when he went to his court, he immediately got arrested because he has a warrant about the federal marshal in that day. For me, it's clear. I don't know exactly how did they get that information, but there is exchange information there or cooperation there.
What do you think needs to happen in Portland, especially for the issue of policing migrant communities? How can it be more just?
They need to separate that collaboration. It needs to be a clear line between the police and ICE. Police is for protecting the safety in our community, and it's not his job, it's not their job to really connect with ICE. Immigration is a totally separate entity that they need to do their job, but not to cooperate with them.
I've been speaking with Romeo Sosa. We've been discussing migrant justice in Portland. Romeo will be part of a community conversation tomorrow from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
Supporters of Oregon Measure 92, which would require the labeling of genetically modified food, filed a lawsuit today claiming that 4,600 valid votes were rejected during the current statewide recount. The lawsuit was filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court against Oregon's Secretary of State Kate Brown and Multnomah County Elections Director Tim Scott. The lawsuit requests a restraining order to stop certification of the recount results until the 4,600 votes are counted. These voters were among about 13,000 who completed, signed, and submitted their ballots on time, but whose votes were not counted because their signatures did not match the signature on file. They were notified and given until November 18th to fix the problem. But the lawsuit claims that many of those voters' signatures changed because of illness or disability. Some of the voters were never notified that their vote was being challenged. Others tried to correct their signature with elections officials, but still find their vote is not being counted. Voters defeated Measure 92 on Election Day, November 4th, by a difference of just 812 votes, which triggered the recount. Counties began the recount on December 2nd and are expected to finish by Wednesday. With 24 of Oregon's 36 counties already submitting their results, Measure 92 has gained only 2 votes. Measure 92 was the most expensive ballot measure in Oregon history, with a total of $30 million spent on the campaign.
A strike by graduate student teachers at the University of Oregon entered its second week today. As finals week begins, exams are being proctored by volunteers and paid non-union graduate students, as well as some paid undergraduates. In some cases, students had the chance to take the grade they had in the class as of December 1st, eliminating the need for a final. Graduate student teachers are striking to add 2 weeks of paid medical or maternity leave per year to their contract. This is the first graduate student teacher strike in 38 years, and despite no progress being made in the initial negotiations, another mediation session will be held tomorrow, December 9th. In anticipation of this meeting, we spoke with Aaron Moberg, the Vice President of Political Education for the Graduate Student Teachers Union.
If you could just give a brief summary of what's been going on since December 1st when the strike started and why the strike.
Sure. So
the GTFF declared impasse in October, so that means we had stalled negotiations with the administration to get a fair contract. And the two main sticking points for our members are paid leave, medical and parental, and a raise to the minimum wage to start to meet the cost of living in Eugene. And so since the strike has began, we have got a lot of community support. We've had pickets going on campus now for 7 days. We have had UPS workers and Sanipac garbage workers and other unionized workers not cross our picket lines. So that's been great. We've been able to stop some campus activity in that sense. We've also had a lot of support from undergrad student associations who have done some of their own actions and demonstrations to support our strike effort. And we, this is our second week of striking, and we are back out on the picket lines today, but we have taken up a more silent picket on campus in respect of the students taking their final exams this week, and then have moved our louder pickets to the edges of campus and to administrative buildings to direct our energies at the people who have the power to sign a contract.
Going into your next mediation session tomorrow, what are your hopes, or what do you hope to take out of that meeting?
Well, we are hopeful that the administration will finally be amenable to discussing language that would guarantee paid leave or something like paid leave in our CBA, in our contract for graduate employees. And thus far, they have refused to even consider language that would make this a guarantee and something contractual. So we're hopeful that that will happen tomorrow.
I see. And is that the failing with the initial offer of starting a fund for parental and medical leave?
Yes, so we were willing to work with this alternative option, which is not paid leave, but is something that the administration came up with for graduate students. But we need language that guarantees access to this fund for graduate employees, because we're a union of employees, not students. And so in our status as workers, we need to make sure that all of our workers have access to that fund and are guaranteed the same benefits as all the other workers.
I see. Now, with the possibility of your strike lasting out to the end of this term, do you have plans to pick up the strike again during the winter term?
Yes, so we are at this point prepared, and our members have voted to stay prepared to striking until we get a fair contract. So we hope that that will be soon this week, but it is possible the strike will continue into winter term.
I see. Erin Moberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Erin Moberg, Vice President of Political Education for the GTFF, the Graduate Teachers Union. For KBOO News, this is Riley Turner.
Workers throughout the state of Oregon may soon be entitled to a full week of paid sick leave, regardless of their employer's size. This may be possible if a bill set to go before the Oregon State Legislature early next year passes. Although Portland and Eugene both require paid sick leave, 47% of workers outside these two cities don't have access to the paid time off. A similar bill that failed in last year's session limited the sick leave requirement to companies with six or more workers. Other changes in the current proposed bill include an expanded definition of family members whom workers could use their earned sick time to care for, as well as a requirement for employees to give 10 days' notice when their sick leaves are foreseeable. Governor John Kitzhaber has voiced support for the proposed bill and offered help to get it passed. Mandatory paid sick leave was approved last year by the Portland City Council, which made Portland one of the first major cities to offer it.
Evening news. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with a representative of Flush the Trans-Pacific Partnership about an action today in Washington, D.C. to try to disrupt the negotiation of that secret trade deal. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. Two new collective members in the struggle for justice for the working class will join us on tonight's show. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, featuring an interview with Bridges to Change, an organization whose mission is to strengthen individuals and families affected by addiction, poverty, and homelessness. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy with a chance of with a high of 58 and a low of 53. 80% chance of rain in the Portland area. Today in history, on December 8th, 1980, 44 years ago today, John Lennon was assassinated by Mark David Chapman in front of the Dakota in New York City. The quote of the day is from John Lennon, who said, "Our society is being run by insane people for insane objectives. I think we're being run by maniacs for maniacal ends, and I think I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. That's what's insane about it."
It's 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Like a dog chewing a bone down to nothing, congressional right-wingers have been gnawing on the so-called scandal of Benghazi for more than 2 years,
heard that John Lennon
growling
quote.
That there's a dark conspiracy a inside in there, huh? It involving Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But all of their gnawing and growling has come down to this: nothing. The September 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, certainly was a night of horror. The American consulate was reduced to rubble and 4 Americans were killed, including Ambassador Chris Stevens. But where others saw the longstanding need to fund better security at these diplomatic hotspots, GOP hotheads sniffed political red meat and jumped on it. They've been holding a nonstop 3-ring circus of hearings and media events ever since, alleging a massive cover-up of Obama-Clinton perfidy. But now comes a report documenting that none of that is true. There was no intelligence failure in the Benghazi attack, no order from on high for a CIA rescue team to stand down, no nixing of a military rescue, and no intentional effort by the White House to mislead the public. The significance of this report is that it is not some whitewash put out by Democrats, but the product of the GOP-controlled House Intelligence Committee. Chairman Mike Rogers, a Michigan Republican, says that his committee's exhaustive 2-year investigation found no wrongdoing by officials in the White House, State Department, CIA, or Benghazi itself. Instead of the loss of life being a product of diabolical political intrigue by U.S. leaders, as the right wing alleges, it was, in fact, a horrible result of terrorism. This is Jim Hightower saying, so that's that, right? Ha! While the bone of the Benghazi scandal is gone, the right-wingers now have their own party's investigative report to gnaw on. Thus, the zombie of Benghazi lives on.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Wall Street lobbyists are attempting to secure taxpayer backing for large derivative losses by major U.S. banks. The bank lobbyists are attempting to add the new derivative rules to a funding bill designed to keep the federal government operating through the end of the year. The new regulations would allow banks to trade derivatives from accounts insured by the FDIC. The FDIC is a United States-backed corporation that guarantees the safety of bank deposits up to $250,000. Federal law requires the FDIC to hold at least 1% of the value of all cash bank deposits in reserve to pay for any bank depositor losses. Currently, the FDIC has less than $50 billion in assets on hand to cover bank deposit losses, well under the required 1% reserve amount. The 5 largest banks in America own almost $300 trillion worth of derivatives, 10,000 times larger than the current FDIC reserves. If the new regulations introduced into the spending bill were to become a law, the FDIC and the U.S. taxpayer could be held liable for any large derivative losses by U.S. banks. Many critics are worried that highly leveraged oil derivatives currently owned by major U.S. banks could face large losses if the price of oil continues to fall. If the large oil derivatives were to collapse in value, the banks could fail similar to the collapse of the Bear Stearns Bank that precipitated the 2008 worldwide economic crash. The United States government and taxpayers could then be on the hook for losses of more than 10 times the GDP of the United States if the proposed regulation changes become law. The main proponent of the new derivative regulations is Democratic Party Congressman Jim Hines from Connecticut, a former vice president for Goldman Sachs.
The state of Washington houses the most polluted nuclear weapons production site in the nation, but the site probably won't be on a strict cleanup schedule anytime soon. The federal government said that the state-requested cleanup deadlines would require an extra $18 billion over the next 14 years and should be rejected as too expensive. The U.S. Department of Justice argued that spending so much money for the project at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation would jeopardize other nuclear cleanup projects across the country. The Justice Department and the state of Washington both filed documents last week in U.S. District Court regarding the state's lawsuit requesting a faster cleanup of Hanford. The state pushed for the court to require strict supervision of Hanford's leaky underground waste containers, with 100 new deadlines to keep the Department of Energy on track. It also requested the construction of a $13 billion long-term waste storage plant. The Department of Justice called both these demands unrealistic. The state's call for cleanup comes after several decades of nuclear weapon construction at Hanford. This production created radioactive waste that hasn't been properly dealt with under the Department of Energy's maintenance deadlines.
Oil giant BP's legal challenge to a compensation deal over the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill has been rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court. The decision means that BP will have to make payments as a result of its role in the worst oil spill in history. BP asked the Supreme Court to consider whether people and businesses seeking payments under the settlement included those who had not actually suffered injury as a result of the spill. The rejection of BP's appeal is a setback in its attempt to try to limit payments over the disaster. The settlement has no cap, and the oil firm now says that it can no longer give an estimate for how much the deal would cost. The settlement process is not a part of the environmental or criminal penalties that BP must face as a result of the spill. New Orleans federal judge Carl Barbier ruled in September that BP was grossly negligent in events leading up to the 2010 disaster. The same judge also found BP subcontractors Transocean and Halliburton negligent.
A group of activists in Peru today shut down what they called a greenwashed fossil fuel industry panel at the United Nations climate talks. Protesters donned T-shirts that read, "Get the F-F-out," referring to fossil fuels. Activists from indigenous communities in Colombia, Peru, Canada, and other communities affected by fossil fuel development spoke about the environmental and human rights violations frequently perpetrated by fossil fuel companies. KBOO's Yana Maximova is on the ground in Lima and captured some of the voices of the activists. This segment begins with Godwin Ojo of Friends of the Earth Nigeria.
The Niger Delta community have been terribly impacted. They have ruined the rural economies of the people. According to the United Nations program, UNEP report 2011, released to the government, UNEP report has recommended $1 billion as initial cleanup grant, cleanup fund. As we speak, Shell has not committed. They have not cleaned up. They are not willing to clean up. They continue to deceive, to use the language of deception against the people. This is why there's anger and violence in the Niger Delta.
And what about Chevron's role here at the climate change conference?
Chevron's role has to do with the situation in Ecuador, where the court, a Supreme Court in Ecuador has ruled that Chevron is guilty of environmental degradation in the communities, and therefore fined them about $8 billion. Of course, Chevron is running away. It's not willing to pay. This is the anger against Chevron. So Chevron and Shell, there's no choice between the two.
And what about Chevron in the Niger Delta?
Same. Shell is not better than Chevron.
The chief researcher for Shell was at the panel, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change.
Yeah.
As a representative of a corporation, of industry. Virtually his response was, it's unrealistic that we leave all oil in the ground, and the solution that he offered was carbon capture and storage. Can you comment on that?
I think they are far behind the world. They are really far behind. And the argument they put forward in addition to that is that we can't stop oil now. Who is saying that the oil should be stopped now? We are talking of energy transition. We recognize that there's things to be done within the transition period. But they need to sign up to energy transition. They need to understand that dirty energy has no place of the future for sustainable energy. So that is the module, that is the paradigm shift that civil society groups are giving, are pushing. And we don't understand why the oil companies are not getting it. It is time to intensify effort and make investment for renewable energy feeding tariffs.
Do you feel like they're trying to buy more time to suck their earth dry?
They are not just buying. To say that they are buying more time is to reduce their strategy. They are actually out to scuttle. They are out to deceive. They are out to make sure that they continue to make profit while people bleed to the hospitals. Oil is drilled behind military shields in Nigeria. So they continue to make profit, but human rights violations continue unabated. So they don't understand those kind of economies. Everything that is in the way of profit is seen as obstacle. This is the mindset of oil companies. And we are seriously opposed to that.
They've got billions and billions of dollars invested in oil. But as we know, the climate science says we have to leave at least 80% of all of known reserves in the soil. That's going to mean big losses for the profits of Shell. So I'm not surprised, and none of us should be surprised, which is why we really can't afford to have them anywhere near these negotiations and anywhere near climate policy making.
The NDCs are here to support and to stand by. Which is a reflection of what is going to happen more and more in those developing countries because of, not because of their responsibility, but with the responsibility of the developed world's years and years of emissions that has caused the warming and climate change. And we are calling again and again that those countries will have to raise their ambition in cutting their emissions. We have to remember that developing countries, their main objective is to secure their development. This is clear. They have to advance their sustainable development, their poverty reduction, but still they also have the responsibility, according to the fair shares, to contribute towards mitigation. But this, again, as Lidi said, will have to come from the developed world as part of their contribution, what they will be doing domestically, which is not enough. They have to cover financially contributions to the developing world to do their own their contribution towards mitigation.
Those were the sound of activists at the climate summit currently underway in Lima, Peru, recorded by KBOO's reporter on the ground, Yana Maximova.
At least 11 people were killed early Saturday in a failed attempt to rescue American hostage Luke Summers in Yemen. A woman, a 10-year-old boy, and local al-Qaeda leader were among the people killed, alongside two Western hostages, which included Summers, an American photojournalist, and Pierre Corky, a South African teenager. The hostages were killed by their captors, militants from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, when they discovered the rescue effort in progress. President Obama authorized the operation, which was led by about 35 Navy SEAL Team 6 soldiers, after concluding that Summers' life was in imminent danger. It was the second U.S. military attempt to rescue Summers from Yemen in the past 2 weeks. In the first raid, which took place on November 25th, U.S. commandos freed 8 hostages and killed 7 militants, but were unable to locate Summers, who apparently had been moved several days before the operation. In an apparent response to the first raid, Summers' captors said they would kill him by Saturday unless unspecified demands were met. Summers, who had been working as a freelance editor and photojournalist in Yemen, was kidnapped in September 2013. Summers' fellow hostage, Pierre Corky, had been expected to be freed Sunday, according to The Gift of the Givers, a South African relief organization with projects in Yemen and connections to tribal leaders in the area. American officials said they were not aware of those arrangements. Abdel Razak al-Jamal, a Yemeni journalist who specializes in covering Islamist militants, said the kidnappers may have been originally intended to ransom Summers as well, but appeared to have been angered by the first rescue attempt. At a press conference earlier today, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest addressed reporters' questions on the failed rescue attempt.
We know that the review is underway of how families are involved in that process, but is some kind of coordination or family interaction ahead of a raid even possible moving forward?
Well, part of the review that the president has ordered does involve the communication between the federal government and the families that are in this terrible situation. And as I mentioned earlier, our thoughts and prayers are with the Summers family. It's difficult to comprehend the level of grief they must be feeling today. The only practical time in which this raid could be carried out would have been Friday night. And that's why the president acted quickly. That's why our special operators acted quickly. That's why we worked quickly with the Yemen government to ensure that this was well coordinated. That's what was necessary in order to try to save his life.
So, I know we don't want to talk about hypotheticals, but if there was, say, in this case, a longer time frame to work with, is consultation with the family something that would be considered?
That's difficult to say, Michelle, because it's each situation is different and each situation is unique. There obviously are significant operational security concerns when you're carrying out a raid like this, that the element of surprise is critically important, not just for the success of the operation, but also for the safety of the operators. So the amount of information that can be shared with anybody is very limited. That would have an impact on what is communicated to the family, but it's not necessarily determinative in terms of what is eventually communicated to them.
That was Josh Earnest, White House Press Secretary, talking with reporters today about the failed U.S. attempt to rescue American hostage Luke Summers in Yemen early Saturday.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territory.